You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
The year is 1960, and showers will never be the same. The movie? Psycho. Hello, everybody, and welcome to
Unspooled.
I'm Amy Nicholson.
And I am Paul Scheer. And this is the podcast where we go through the AFI's top 100 films of all time to see, are they as good as people think? And so far, they're pretty damn good.
Pretty damn good. That is a ringing endorsement, Paul. Last week, we did Lord of the Rings. We did Fellowship of the Ring, the very first installment of the trilogy and the only one elected into the AFI Top 100 list. At the top, I want to apologize. I mentally spaced when I was talking about seeing The Hobbit in a 3D way that made me lose my mind. I got all my, like, high-resolution things that start with 4 wrong, and I was talking about 4K when I should have said 48 frame rate,
right.
48 frames per second, as opposed to the normal 24.
Well, I knew what you were talking about.
Sorry about that.
And for me, I also made a mistake where I confused Liv Tyler as starring in Pearl Harbor, and it was actually Kate Beckinsale. I was thinking about Liv Tyler in Armageddon. No big deal. We're back on the same page now. But there's been a lot of interesting conversations going on, especially on our Twitter page. Steven, who is at A Little Older on Twitter, he writes that he thought there was an interesting parallel between how the orcs were kind of created and how tanks were manufactured during World War One, and maybe Tolkien was inspired or even like frightened by like this industrial revolution. I don't know.
I like that because that image of the orcs, which we didn't really talk about in enough depth, I think, was them getting like taken out of the mud and sort of embryonic. And what on earth are they getting created from? And what is happening here? But there is this very giant factory looking industrial sweeping shot of this mine, you know, with ladders everywhere.
Yes.
It looks incredibly industrial.
I totally agree. This next one's written by Vencia. And here's a question for you. Would you pick Harry Potter, Order of the Phoenix over Swing Time?
No. I'm just going to say no, but I also want to like asterisk the idea of could I swap in anything else for Swing Time that's like a musical from Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers?
Sure.
And I would have them in a heartbeat.
All right, but how about Ben-Hur versus Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows?
Ah! I mean, no, I'm just going to say no. I'm going to be my hardliner modernist. No.
I am also going to agree with you because Ben-Hur, even without having seen Ben-Hur, I knew about that chariot scene. I don't think there is an iconic scene from Deathly Hallows that is more culturally relevant. That's what I'm going to stand on right now. I don't know. This one's from Babs Van. She just says that she loves listening to Amy because she finds it extremely gratifying to have a smart woman rip into the white male canon that is the AFI Top 100. She said, listening to the Unspooled podcast is like therapy. Looking at you, Apocalypse Now episode.
Yeah, I gotta say, Paul, when we started doing this show, that wasn't even on my mind that we'd be doing this at all.
Yeah.
At all. There's something about this year that makes all these films feel extra alive. Yeah.
One great one. This is from Catherine Tucson, who said that she just watched The Sixth Sense with her 11-year-old daughter, and she had a brand new perspective on Bruce Willis's understated performance. Her daughter said that Bruce Willis acted the way adults act when they're trying to keep secrets from children. And I thought that was a very insightful thing. You have a very smart 11-year-old, and I thought that was a different way to look at this character. Could Bruce be so in it that we didn't even realize it?
That is really insightful. That really impressed me because when I read that, I thought, oh my God, I forgot. I forgot what it's like to be a kid and you have an adult who's smiling a little bit too much, a little too numb, a little bit like everything's fine and you don't trust it.
I totally agree. Now, Amy, we are going to be talking about a Hitchcock classic. And I think it's one of those rare movies where a location is as popular as the actual movie. I think everyone knows the Bates Motel. And I think it's synonymous with a place where you'd go to get murdered. But you know what? It seems like a really great spot, too. If that damn highway just came where it was supposed to come, it would have been a huge success. And we wanted you, our listeners, to call in with maybe some compliments, some positive Yelp reviews for the Bates Motel. So let's take a listen.
Hi there. I just stayed at the Bates Motel, and I have to say, very impressive to leave an entire newspaper full of cash on the nightstand for your guests.
Bates Motel, very kitschy. Very cute, taxidermy, and lots of candy corn.
And I really must say, I've never stayed anywhere with better water pressure in the showers, totally refreshed.
The water heater works so well that you can turn it on while you're already in the shower, and it's instantly hot.
It seems to be open 24 hours, rain or shine. It's right off the highway. When the young caretaker took my bags to my room.
There are always vacancies, even if the sign isn't on. The motel is very clean. However, they do offer a wake-up call, but checkout time can be earlier than expected. 4 stars.
I love the Bates Motel. 5 stars. It's got great breakfast cooking in the morning, just like Mom used to make. Just like Mom used to make.
I mean, Paul, I'll say I'm a sucker for a complimentary breakfast and also a delivery of sandwiches.
Oh, I mean, come on. You can never get sandwiches delivered to your room by the hotel owner. I mean, that's a very rare thing. And I'm glad that someone pointed out that taxidermy. That looked very hard. And you know what? It shows you how good he is because he couldn't do it as well for his mother.
It's true. The beasts. The beasts. They'll never get it done.
All right, Amy, let's get into it. Number 14 on the list, Psycho, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, written by Joseph Stefano, based on a book by Robert Bloch, starring Anthony Perkins, Janet Leigh, Vera Miles, also Martin Balsam, and, as Hitchcock himself called him, John Gavin, the Stiff.
The Stiff.
The movie came out in 1960. Tell us a little bit about what it's about.
Yeah, Psycho is about a woman who's having an affair with a man who lives a state away as a hardware clerk salesman dude. She wants to get married. He says they're in debt. So one day, impulsively, she steals $40,000 from her boss and decides to drive towards him on a road trip to disaster. And then in the second half of the film, her sister and her ex-boyfriend try to figure out what happened to Marion Crane.
And, you know, you said something right off the bat that I wanted to ask you about. You said affair, but is it an affair if both people are single?
Oh, that's true. It feels affair-ish since they're
doesn't it?
A motel room in the middle
of
the day.
I was thinking about that and watching it this time, that the opening feels so kind of like secretive, like they're there. And
the
I was
shades
like,
are drawn. They got the noir blind thing happening.
They leave at separate times. And it was the first time watching it that I realized, oh, they're just a couple in love that happen to have some issues, but not really big ones.
Yeah, but they are talking about things like respectability versus disrespectability, about ex-wives and alimony,
right.
And they make it sound sordid. And she makes it feel like she thinks it's sordid. And she's in her bra, which is very, very shocking.
Well, let's talk about that. The sensuality in this movie. You know, you have people in bras. You have people laying on the bed at the same time. I mean, is this the first time you're seeing people in the same bed in a sexual way?
I don't know if it's the first, but it's definitely one of the ones that people are like, oh, he's doing it.
Right, right.
It definitely felt like, hi, I'm Hitchcock. I just made North by Northwest. I can kind of do anything I want right now. This is me taking my knife and stabbing the death knell into the Hays Code as much as I can.
Well, it's crazy because this is Hitchcock going, I've just had my biggest hit. Now I'm going to make this small, you know, and to use today's term, Blumhouse-style film. This is a movie that was shot using, like, his TV crew to keep the money down.
Well, yeah. I mean, Hitchcock was influenced by the Blumhouse of his day. He was influenced by Roger Corman. He was influenced by people who were making these cheap movies like Machine Gun Kelly with Charles Bronson. And he said, that makes a ton of money if you do something for cheap and I want in that business.
Then the budget was $800,000, which was 1/5 of North by Northwest. It's crazy.
It's crazy. And North by Northwest has like airplanes and giant shots and color and it's beautiful. And I think he was having so much fun working within restrictions, which I totally get. Do you remember when you were like a kid and you would be in English class and your teacher would make you do a free writing exercise?
Yeah.
And how if it was like, write anything, it was really hard. But if like you have unlimited imagination, but if it was like it has to have a cat and a knife and an apple, you're like, oh, I got this. I feel like that is such a great example of the creative brain at work. Like, give it a limitation and it works twice as hard.
I totally agree. Did you ever see The Five Obstructions?
Yes.
It's this Lars von Trier kind of doc, and it's exactly that. His, you know, Lars von Trier's film professor is kind of in a creative rut, and he gives him very specific things to accomplish within remaking his classic short film. It's a great one. I don't want to wreck it, but you should definitely check it out. Just a great idea of how to kind of reignite yourself by kind of cornering yourself.
Exactly. And I feel like that's what Hitchcock kind of wanted to do with Psycho. He wanted to make sure his brain didn't get lazy. He wanted to give himself a bunch of obstructions in terms of budget, in terms of a story that was going to shock people, and see if he could still pull it off. He wanted to see if he could feel young-brained again.
It was something that no one believed in. You know, so here's a guy coming off of the apex of his career, and no one is cutting him any slack. They're just like, it's not going to work. They're trying to pull the budget.
They won't commit to putting it in wide release.
Yeah, they wanted to edit it for TV, I think, at one point even, and make it like part of an Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And I never realized that because growing up, it's the most popular one just by sheer box office numbers. It made $15 million.
It's the highest on our list. There's four Hitchcocks on the list. This is our first one we're getting to, but this is number 14. And then below it, you have, I think, North by Northwest, Vertigo, and Rear Window.
And a lot of people say that Vertigo is one of the best movies of all time. I think that there's a lot of debate between Vertigo and Citizen Kane. We'll get into that when we talk about Vertigo. But this film, if we're talking about its importance, I think really revolutionized the genre of horror. You know, because it's doing things that we now take for granted, but I can't imagine what it was like going to the theater to see this. You know, one of the things that he did, and I never knew this, and I kind of learned that from the Inside Psycho podcast, which is a great kind of podcast if you really want to go on a deep dive about Psycho. I guess back in 1960, movies would just play on a loop, and you would pay to go in, and you'd go in at any point. So you would just pay your money, you'd go in, oh, it's in the middle, you'd stay until it restarted again. And Hitchcock in this film was like, no, you can't enter in the middle. You have to enter in at the beginning. And it was a very firm thing. Like, he essentially created movie start times. I mean, this movie started that trend, which I never knew. And it's, of course, you wouldn't want to walk in the middle because it would wreck the entire illusion that he's doing. It's this kind of magic trick. This whole movie is a kind of a magic
trick.
Yeah,
what would happen if you walked in at minute 50 when it was just like the sister and Sam looking for Marion? Yeah, I always found that so interesting too. You know, the idea that films used to just sort of play in a loop. It's like, here's your feature, here's your B picture, here's some newsreels, here's some cartoons, here's your feature.
Yeah.
I never quite understood how that worked for an audience before, but it was absolutely just the way things were done. And when he made this announcement, people were like, don't oppress me, man.
Yeah. And I think from second one, we have to talk about this score because that's your first introduction to this movie, this Bernard Herrmann score. We heard him in Taxi Driver. This is the more classical Bernard Herrmann that I think we all know. And then you have this like Saul Bass title sequence, and it just gets you in immediately. You feel this tension the same way that I think the music in Taxi Driver gives you this uneasy feeling, but it's different or grander.
Yeah, with these like Saul Bass fonts. And Saul Bass is just one of the most incredible visual designers we've ever had. You have Alfred Hitchcock's name zooming into the credits and then fracturing. Like even he's under this stress. It feels like an earthquake type of font.
Yeah.
Although, can I admit something really dorky to you? Please don't judge me for this. It's just because of when I was born. My first sample of the Psycho score was not watching Psycho. It was in a Busta Rhymes song.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You people had enough? Give me some more. You people want the wild hair? Give me some more. You're split for the cheese
out? Give me some more. You know we always need that? Give me some more. Even though we're getting money, you can give me some more. Wow, so you saw this before you saw Psycho?
I did. I did. I had no idea that Busta Rhymes didn't come up with that. I'm sorry, I was young.
That's amazing. No, of course, that's great. I'm the same way. I'll be listening to a song that comes out like recently and then realize only like a year later that like, oh, that's a Stevie Wonder hook. That's why it's so good.
Exactly, because we are children who came of age in the era of samples.
Yeah.
And so it has been that thing of like retroactively being like, oh, that's what that is from. Now I understand this. Da-da-da-da-da. Yeah. Kind of like, I don't know, like, so much of what I saw parodied on The Muppet Show, then I later was like, oh, that's where that is from. Or The Simpsons, honestly.
Well, no, but that's the whole thing. I think that, you know, something like Psycho has been so, you know, in our zeitgeist for such a long time that I don't even know how to watch this movie without knowing a little bit about it.
It's true. I believe and this is one of the things I really want to examine when we talk about Psycho today, that it is impossible to try to watch this and understand what it was like to see it in 1960.
Yes.
Because the two things Hitchcock was trying to hide, one, Marion Crane dies. Two, he's pretending to be his mom. And those are the two number one things we know about this movie, period. And everything else in this movie, like, people, I think you could forget that Vera Miles even exists.
Oh, absolutely. The movie has big blind spots, or at least what you remember of the movie. It's like, oh, right. Like, sometimes I even forget the beginning, or, like, you know, you forget. And the end is pretty unmemorable, ultimately. Like, the investigation into Vera Miles is not like what I think of when I think of Psycho. I really think of that chunk of her coming, them sitting in the room with the taxidermy, and then the shower scene, you know, and then the very end with, you know, with the therapist and him alone in the, you know, insane asylum or police station.
Yeah. So I feel a little robbed of being that audience in 1960 who saw her get stabbed in the shower and lost their minds.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it's such a great trick for a filmmaker who I think has similarities to M. Night, who was able to always figure out a new way to kind of put you off balance. I mean, when we start off in Rope, you know, you're watching one sort of tension. This is a whole different sort of tension because you're unaware of what this movie is. Like, you don't, you know, as an audience, you're watching just a movie about this woman who is stealing money. We don't know it's a horror movie. We don't know it's a thriller. We don't know what is happening. You know, it could have very well been just her losing her mind because she committed this crime, you know. So even to think of a murder scene in this, you know, when you're watching it, must have been so out of the blue.
Yeah, what I find so fascinating about the Psycho script, having it be very, very, very ruined, as I'm sure it is for everybody else, is that it's really the study in the fact that he made a script where every single plot beat is basically a misdirection,
mm-hmm.
where he's, like, really obsessed with this $40,000. And he's like, look at her trying to hide it. Look at where the money is after she's dead. Is he going to find the money? Where everybody in this film is obsessed with the money. Is he going to buy a hotel with it? What's he going to do? Is he trying to get out of the hotel? And they're chasing this plot thread that leads absolutely nowhere. The money does not matter in the slightest. And that happens over and over again. It happens with the car. She's like, gotta swap out my car. There's a whole deal about being in the car lot.
Yes.
And then the car just sinks in the swamp and it doesn't matter. And over and over and over again, everything people are pursuing is really futile. None of it adds up to what we think is happening. And I believe that even ultimately at the end, the psychiatrist's assessment of Norman Bates is also wrong. Like, everybody's wrong about everything. Norman Bates' psychiatrist is like, oh, he was sexually attracted to her, and that's why she had to die. Partially true, but really what I think it is that in that awesome scene right before she dies when they're talking in the taxidermy room over sandwiches, she's pressuring him to break up with his mom.
Right.
And that's what the psychiatrist never knows, and that's what they always miss about it. She was dangerous because of what she says here.
Wouldn't it be better if you put her someplace?
You mean an institution? A madhouse? People always call a madhouse someplace, don't they? Put her in someplace.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it to sound uncaring.
What do you know about caring? Have you ever seen the inside of one of those places? The laughing and the tears. And the cruel eyes studying you. My mother there. But she's harmless. She's as harmless as one of those stuffed birds.
You know, I love that because there is this kind of foreshadowing, too. You know, he tells her that she eats like a bird. He's stuffed those birds. You know, then
he says if he leaves his mom, it'll be like she's cold in the grave.
I love this scene because I think we're always trying to figure out who the real Norman is. And he changes with his interaction with each person. Like when Sam comes to visit him, he's much more cocky than he is here. And
yeah, with Sam, he's like hands in pockets. Jumping up the stairs.
Yeah.
Hey, buddy. Oh, yeah. Give me $10.
Well, do you think that maybe he's more of a multiple personality disorder than he is someone who is, as they say at the end, a transvestite? Which, by the way, was a word they didn't even want to use in the actual movie. The MPAA were like, you can't say that. And then they had to show that that was like an actual medical term. They thought they were just trying to slip in vulgarity at the end. Like,
which
is a crazy idea there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, what really stands out about that conversation is Marion's change within it. Here's how I see Marion, and really the whole movie. Like, Marion is this woman who is incredibly sexualized by everybody in it. You know, she walks into her office and this cowboy is like, hey, let's go to Vegas. Right. She's selling her car and the guys are kind of like, hey, a little bit. And then they kind of chill out. With Anthony Perkins, he keeps sexualizing her and she's very confused by it. Like when he's like, I brought you sandwiches. And she's like, oh, let's eat in my room. Totally normal.
Right.
And he's like, suddenly recoils. Like her room is this den of snakes.
Right.
And so she's in this kind of uncomfortable dinner scene with him, not really wanting to be there, being very checked out, being like, oh, tell me more about your hobbies and that way you do to just have somebody talk until you can leave. And then she finally does engage with him, and that's when he decides that he's mad. And it's a sort of tragedy of like her finally being like, this man is safe to connect to as a person, and he's totally not.
You know, we've all been in a situation where like, I need to get out of here. And she, and you see it on her face and in her eyes that like she knows – not that she, it's dangerous, but it's weird. It's like, I need to get out of the pool now. This is not a good place to be.
But she's so good at being sort of polite and deflective, which you see already with the cowboy. You know, when she's looking at the cowboy, nice money. Oh, your daughter. You know, she very much humors him and basically does everything but roll her eyes when he turns around from her. And that's why, like, I love the scenes kind of building up to that right in the middle where she loses her temper with the cop and with the car man. Because that's when you get to see the sort of angry Marion appear. Where she's like, I am not putting up with your shit right now. Like, give me this car.
And this is like one of the best leading women that we've had in the movies that we've talked about so far. Because she is incredibly fully developed and she has a lot of sides to her.
You like her. Like, that, that was always the surprise to me is like knowing the twist of Psycho before I saw Psycho is just assuming she was this like innocent blonde who showed up and got stabbed. Right. And then realizing, no, she was this complicated woman. She was a thief. Right. You know, she was a woman who had sex before marriage, a little bit eyebrow waggling in 1960.
But she also is someone who made a mistake, and we can all see ourselves in that. Like, she's not a thief. She made a mistake in a moment, and she's going to go rectify it to a certain degree, right? So, but it starts that trope that I think becomes the future of horror films, which is, you know, once you do something wrong, have sex, you do, you know, so then you're okay to be killed, right? Basically, in the 80s, it was like, if you had sex, Jason could kill you, Freddy could kill you, and that was okay.
Yeah, it's basically this family line 1-2 punch. You have Janet Leigh having sex and stealing money and getting stabbed, and then her daughter, Jamie Lee Curtis, in Halloween, not having sex and surviving.
Right. I love the way he shows her transformation through these, like, very subtle choices. Like, in the beginning, we see her in a white bra before she steals anything, and then she steals something, she's in a black bra. But the thing I wanted to talk to you about was the eyes. When she's driving and she's either imagining what people are saying about her or we are hearing what people are saying about her, you're going into her eyes. And at the end of the movie, we're doing that same shot with Norman. And at that moment, I think Hitchcock is trying to draw this parallel. Like, this is the same craze. These are people that are both crazy. One kind of pulls up and goes in the opposite direction, kind of remedies it, and Norman kind of feeds into it. But I feel like that idea, like that shot of her eyes when she's driving, two hands on the wheel, and when he's in there, he's like, I'm not going to hurt a fly. That is the same shot. It's the same idea of showing that there is something going on in their head. I don't know. I think it has to be intentional because I feel like it's a very specific shot that he's going for.
I never actually put that together before, that you have these two scenes with so much voiceover narration, kind of telling you what this person is thinking and also saying you don't necessarily have to trust what this person thinks they're hearing.
Right. I read into that scene that we just played. I think that Norman's mother is inside of him. So when she says you need to put your mother in a place, that's Norman's mother almost coming forward and going, what? Why would you, you know, it's like, you know, like that idea. Like, so it's like, so that's the conflict within him is that he has this mother that's telling him, I'm not going to, don't do this, don't do that.
That's when the mother is like, this woman is a threat.
Right.
Although I have this question, which is, I wonder how much that voice that we hear him channeling of his mother is who his mother might have actually been. And because his mother kind of talks to him a little bit like playground bullying almost. She doesn't sound like a mom in all the scenes. She sounds like a jerk that he might have known in middle school, but which is why it's like, is it like the synergy of every negative feeling he has about his mom in through this playground boy language?
Well, I always talk about it like this. The way that you remember people is always colored by the way that they make you feel. So, you know, this is his version of his mother. You know, it's not like, you know, you can have a couple in here and you can have them both tell you about a fight or what someone said versus what they meant, but it's your impression of how they made you feel. So I did see Psycho 4. I've seen all the Psychos. I like Psycho 4. Truth be told, I haven't seen it in about like 15 years. It was a prequel. It was like seeing what his relationship was with his mother. I believe it was Henry Thomas played young Norman Bates in that. And I believe it's Olivia Hussey playing Norman's mother. And their relationship is like highly tinged with like this weird sexual thing and then also a little bit abusive. I didn't see Bates Motel, and I know they kind of get into that even a little bit more in Bates Motel, like what that relationship was.
Also, I love that it's Olivia Hussey in that movie because you know she's the actress in Black Christmas, which is one of those other great like interim slashers between Psycho and Halloween.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Black Christmas?
No.
Oh, it's great. Oh, you'll really like
it.
Oh,
I gotta check it out.
Oh, it's great. But have you seen the Psycho remake, the Gus Van Sant one?
Yes. I've seen it 3 times. Once was out of pure curiosity. Once was out of the fact that I forgot that I had seen it. And I was like, I just want to watch it again. And then when we were doing this podcast, there's a thing on YouTube where you can watch both films simultaneously. So yeah, it's great. Both movies are there. So one's on the top and one's on the bottom. And you can kind of scroll through. And I was watching that because I thought that was interesting to see like what Gus Van Sant did. And it's, you know, I think it's often like ridiculed for being a shot for shot remake. And it is and it isn't.
It really isn't. Yeah. I just rewatched it too for this podcast because I'm really interested in this idea of like trying to replicate art. Like, can you ever replicate art? And in a way, Gus Van Sant did when he remade Psycho exactly what Alfred Hitchcock did when he did the original Psycho. Gus Van Sant was like, yo, I just won an Oscar for Good Will Hunting. How about I do Psycho? And everyone's like, what are you talking about? And he's like, ta-da.
I thought that Vince Vaughn was a terrible choice for Norman.
He is a little miscast, yeah.
Because it's, I think you go in a couple different directions, but I think one of the things that I love about Anthony Perkins, and what kind of like bums me out, is I think he's fantastic in this movie, but not nominated. This movie got nominated for 4 Oscars, and it's a Best Actress for Janet Leigh, Best Director for Hitchcock, Best Cinematography, and Best Art Direction, but not Anthony Perkins, who I think he's doing the lion's share of the acting in this movie, but whatever.
He's so boyish, which I really like about him. And he's so nervous and he's so lanky.
But yet he switches it with in different moments with different people. Like you see him turn, like when he's talking to Sam, and you see him talking to the detective. You know, it's like, I don't know. I think there's multiple layers going on there.
Yeah. I mean, he looks like Demi Lovato, which is also kind of a thing that's happening in there. Did you know that he was like a pop star right before he was in Psycho?
Really?
Yeah. Let's listen to a little bit of Anthony Perkins being charming.
Let's go on a moonlight swim, far away from the crowd, all alone upon the beach. Our lips and our arms close within each other's reach will be.
It's interesting because I think we...
Because you want to go on a moonlight swim to his quarry where he's sinking cars.
But you know what? That's the problem with Anthony Perkins. He's so typecast after this movie. I don't think his career is kind of stunted.
Janet Leigh too. Janet Leigh's career was really stunted after this. I mean, when Psycho was over, here Janet Leigh is giving Hitchcock this great performance and he tells her to her face that he will not cast her anymore. He says, whatever I put you in, the audience will immediately think of Psycho, and it won't be fair to the picture of the character. So he basically just cut her off at the knees and said, thanks for dying. I will never use you again.
Well, I mean, Hitchcock is a notorious kind of prick to women because, you know, he wanted Vera Miles to be in Vertigo, but she wasn't able to because she was pregnant. So Hitchcock like never forgave her for that. So when he put her in Psycho, he dressed her so matronly that it was like kind of like a fuck you, like you will never be sexy again. Like that was his like dig at her.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the movie Hitchcock with our own like Silence of the Lambs, Anthony Hopkins in it. But he has Jessica Biel play Vera Miles, and she's just very upset about all of this. Although I will say, like, I don't know if I've seen any other Vera Miles movies. Off the top of my head, I cannot picture her in anything I've seen. Maybe she's been in the background. I'm not convinced she should have been in Vertigo, but that's just me. But anyways, back to Janet Leigh. I mean, this movie followed Janet Leigh around so much that despite living an entire life, her obituary said, quote, Janet Leigh, comma, shower taker of Psycho is dead. Can you imagine? You do this thing less than a minute of your life. Ugh. A body double does a lot of it, and it is all you are known for in the headline of your death.
That is depressing. What do you think that is? Do you think when you have a movie that is so giant, it's a weird thing to reject these people?
Well, Janet Leigh was a big star when she made Psycho already. Janet Leigh was sort of like like a Jennifer Garner, maybe.
Okay.
Kind of type, where yeah. she was in a very famous marriage. She was married to Tony Curtis, who was in Some Like It Hot, which right. we'll get to. And when Tony Curtis makes Some Like It Hot, he cheats on her with Marilyn Monroe. Doesn't really tell anybody about it until he's like older, but wow. She probably knew.
Yeah, of course.
And they divorced really soon. They divorced like a year or two after Psycho. But I guess the equivalent of us is like, this would be if Jennifer Garner in 2010, when yeah. she's had a couple kids and her relationship with Ben Affleck still looks really rosy in the press,
yeah.
is then in like a Saw movie.
I was going to say Peppermint?
Flayed. Yeah. yeah, it's like.
No, right. Yeah, you're showing somebody in a way that you did not ever intend to see them.
Yeah. Well, you're like, oh, you're a magazine cover actress. You're adorable. Like,
right.
Jenny Lee was like a cute actress. She did a lot of romantic stuff. But she does have this like kind of aristocratic brittleness to her that I really like.
It's a stiffness. But she's I think lovely. It's a – like she's strong. Like she's a strong single woman, you know. Like she makes a choice to steal the money. Like she's not – you know, convinced by her boyfriend to make any bad choices. And I think that that's such a strong choice that she sees a moment – to kind of live the life that she wants to live. And she takes – she's actively taking this thing. No one's yeah. making her take it.
Because in the logic of the 60s, she's a little old to have never been married.
You right.
know, she's been working at this firm for 10 years. I think we find out this guy's coming in and being like, my 18-year-old daughter's getting married. And
right.
there's a little bit of Janet Leigh, why hasn't this happened for you? What's wrong? Like she's a little out of step.
Well, can I just say too, we're just talking about this guy, Tom, who comes in, the cowboy who comes in. I love Tom. I mean – this guy is playing drunk. He's playing, like, he is just balls to the wall, like, scenery chewing. It's such a fun character because I think, in many respects, you're looking at this movie for the first half through her eyes, and you're seeing these men through her, not men looking at her, if that makes sense. You know, watching it this time, I couldn't get that out of my head. It's like, wow, you know, it's really interesting. I think Hitchcock has had a very storied and complicated relationship with a lot of his actresses, and to be able to have that much ability to show a female perspective, I thought was a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, I think he knew exactly what he was doing because his cameo comes right before that, because he's a guy on the street as yes. Marion walks in, and you see him give her a double take,
kind of like the Martin Scorsese in Taxi Driver looking at Cybill Shepherd.
Exactly.
Here's an interesting fact. The reason why the cameo was so early in the movie was because Hitchcock knew that people were going to be looking out for him, so he didn't want to divide people's attention. He was like, let's get it out of the way right away, so now you can be into the movie, which I thought was a very interesting, again, smart choice for this movie where he's going to be doing a million misdirects. He didn't want you to be, like, searching the background for him. It's like, here I am, first scene or, you know, second Whoa. Scene.
Here's Waldo. Go on.
Go on. Now
just
enjoy
admire
the movie.
All the crazy people that I've drawn in the margins of Waldo.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of one of those crazy people, my favorite person in that scene is Caroline, the other
secretary. Oh, I love the other secretary.
Who gives this speech.
You got a headache?
Oh, it'll pass. Headaches are like resolutions. You forget them as soon as they stop hurting.
Have you got some aspirin?
Yeah. I've got something.
Not aspirin. My mother's doctor gave them to me the day of my wedding. Teddy was furious when he found out I'd taken tranquilizers.
First off, by the way, that's Hitchcock's daughter. That's Pat Hitchcock.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Second of all, we're right in the beginning of this film. We're really early on. I mean, this is like minute 7,
right.
I think. We've already had 2 mom drops, if you're paying attention.
Interesting.
She's talking about her mom kind of wedging into her marriage, having her be passed out on the night when she's supposed to bone her husband for the first time.
Right.
Being this wedge issue in her own relationship. And we've just before that already even had this mom name drop by Marion Crane herself.
Oh, we can see each other. We can even have dinner. But respectably. In my house, with my mother's picture on the mantle and my sister helping me broil a big steak for 3.
And after the steak, did we send sister to the movies, turn mama's picture to the wall?
Sam.
Everyone is really aware of their mother's approval.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I think that's more about the time, right? I mean, these are people that, you know, they are, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, are they having an affair? Are they not? Like, well, I guess the thing that they are doing that's wrong is having sex out of wedlock. And, you know, I think this is a time where you still had to keep up appearances, right? Like you had to, like you were living this one side of it.
Yeah. But I think Hitchcock is lacing in
of course,
mom,
yeah.
Mom.
Right. Everyone's got an issue with their mother. But yeah. How does it affect you ultimately? And one person becomes
exactly.
a killer and the others are, yeah.
Exactly. And also lacing in this idea of needing people to approve of what you're doing. And also lacing in this idea of everybody in these opening scenes, even including Marion, has a secret. She has this pretty secret love affair. Caroline's marriage is definitely screwed up, even if she doesn't know about it.
Right.
Their boss hides booze in the house. Everybody is doing something wrong. There's not like a squeaky clean innocent person here.
Can I talk about Hitchcock getting the rights to this, right? So Hitchcock, kind of like Walt Disney in buying property in Florida, does it secretly. He buys this book, the rights to the book, anonymously for $9,000 because he didn't want anyone to know that he was working on this as his next project. And a couple of differences between the book and the movie. Number one, in the book, Norman Bates is described as being middle-aged, pudgy, and unattractive. But the screenwriter, Joseph Tofano, is like, I don't want to do that. I want to do something different. And I think that was actually a really cool choice because I think that that falls more into the typical what we imagine like a serial killer to be. And I think to make him this youthful, spry, like, you know, you would never think twice seeing Anthony Perkins, you know. And then a couple other things in here that I thought were interesting was in the novel, it's explained that Marion and Sam met and fell in love on a cruise. That's why they have a long distance relationship. And the book and the film really used Ed Gein as their basis for this Norman Bates character, which is an interesting thing. Like that, you know, even back then, Ed Gein is kind of often gone to in cinema. Like he's this Texas Chainsaw Massacre has like elements of that. Silence of the Lambs has elements of that. All these movies kind of like go to that story.
And Ed Gein, just remind people of how awful Ed Gein was. You know, he was a serial killer. Serial killer, I might actually say with an asterisk. He was more of like a grave robber who did a few murders.
Okay,
I guess
right.
You could say like dabbled in murder, but was really into defiling bodies. When they went into his house, he had a corset made out of a human female torso. He had leggings made out of human legs. He had made masks out of human faces. He had 9 vulva in a shoebox.
Oh, gosh.
He had a belt made of female human nipples. And he had a pair of lips that he used as a window shade cord.
Oh, God.
So you have to at least give Hitchcock maybe some props, or maybe be like Hitchcock man up, because he didn't go that far at all in this movie.
No, I think it's more interesting to show at the end, we kind of find out that he might have killed 2 other women. You know, might have. We don't know, you know. I like it because it's like we're seeing this character, this Norman Bates character, kind of in the beginning part where if he wasn't caught, what would have happened? If people didn't care about Marion, would he ever have been caught?
And would have many people cared about Marion if she hadn't stolen the money?
Yes. Well, true.
Well, and sort of related to that, when you have this whole investigation of where on earth could Marion Crane be, and you have Arbogast chasing her down, Arbogast even doesn't do like a completely thorough job. Like he never finds the car lot guy. He never finds the cop. He only gets halfway there too.
It's so interesting.
Although he is such a good interrogator when he's like interrogating.
Oh, I love
Bates.
That.
And Bates just sort of is like, oh, she, I barely talked to her. Well, we had sandwiches. Oh, she talked to my mom.
We have reason to believe that she came along this way, may have stopped in the area. Did she stop here?
Well, no one stopped here for a couple of weeks.
Do you mind looking at the picture before committing yourself?
Commit myself? You sure talk like a policeman.
Look at the picture, please.
And I mean, the way that they do, like the angles in this movie for when people are being intimidated and the way the faces really get into screen, it does do a great job of, again, using one lens, and you're getting this, you feel through the cinematography the tension, you know, of how it's shot. That scene of the interrogation when Arbogast comes to Norman Bates is a really tense, I love that scene.
What do you think that shot is during that scene when you have Anthony Perkins lean in front of the camera like he's trying to look at something, and you get this shadowy, really up-close look at his throat as he's sort of swallowing and talking?
I don't know. I think, are you at that point? Because I believe this movie is not told through Norman Bates' perspective. I think it's told through everyone who experiences Norman Bates. Because I think Arbogast is looking at him and seeing the nerves. That's how I took it, like that his throat swallowing. And like you see what someone interrogating someone might be seeing.
It's true.
I don't know.
But also you get that strange little private moment with Norman right at the end when Arbogast drives away.
Mm-hmm.
And he smiles like, nailed it.
Yeah.
Like, no, you did not, buddy.
I know. Well, here's something that I wanted to talk about a little bit. I love Better Call Saul. I think it's a great show. I think Breaking Bad is a great show. But one of the things that Better Call Saul does so much that I really respond to is you can spend minutes on that show just watching people interact in their environment. And I always thought, God, that's so great. And in watching this movie, I'm like, oh, Hitchcock does the same thing. It's just people being in some place. Like, there's a lot of quiet scenes here, whether it's Marion driving, Marion figuring out how to put the money in the newspaper and folding it over and putting it on the thing, getting ready for the shower. There's a lot of silence in letting people exist in space, her packing her bag.
Yeah, like I think my favorite alone scene that we have in this movie is when Norman Bates is cleaning up the blood after Marion Crane has been murdered. And, you know, his cleaning up the blood scene goes on so much longer than Marion Crane getting murdered. It's him. It's how kind of good he is at cleaning up the blood, which is surprising. Like,
well, maybe he's done it twice before.
Exactly. He's like panicked at the beginning, but then there is you. I mean, it's hard to say because I know it's like him. I know it's not his mom.
Right. But I think you're supposed to think that his mother is this psycho, that he's always cleaning up for her, taking care of her. And it does a great job because, you know, when he comes in, the way he gags at seeing that scene for the first time, he's not acting for anybody in that moment. He is literally reacting to the scene. And, you know, I think the thing is that Hitchcock took the bass tones out of his voice for when he first sees, like, oh, no, because he just wanted to create this very innocent-sounding version of himself. And in that scene, by the way, we have to talk about this, a big first in movie history, a toilet flush on screen. Why was a toilet flush so verboten at this time?
Yeah, it's astounding.
Like, it's an empty toilet. It's not, you know, it's papers being put in there.
Yeah, I wonder, did we really go, what, 70 years of movie history at this point without ever acknowledging that human beings have bodily functions?
Well, look, we've been put married couples in beds. I guess they were really trying to protect people.
I mean, I guess it's like all the censors were acting like Norman Bates in this scene where he can't even say the word bathroom.
Stationery with Bates Motel printed on it in case you want to make your friends back home feel envious. And the, over there.
The bathroom.
Yeah.
I think he's afraid to say bathroom because he's cleaned up a murder in the bathroom before. Like, it's not like he's afraid of the bathroom. It's like he knows that that's like, that's where they've got the peephole. He's not the peephole in every cabin. It's just only in one. Like, do you think that maybe he murdered the people the same way? And I don't know.
I don't think he's thinking about murdering her here.
I don't think he is, but he cleaned up the blood there twice before. If we are to believe that he killed those two women,
okay,
could be a prude.
Blunt question.
Yeah.
Norman Bates, virgin?
Yeah, I feel like a virgin. And I feel, and look, based on my knowledge of Psycho 4, I think he was sexually attracted to his mother.
His mom looks like she would have been real old, though.
Well, I mean, he didn't really take care of her body that well after she passed. Amy, we're talking about the bathroom, and I feel like this is maybe a perfect time to really get into the most famous scene in the film. And what better way to do that than with a literal expert? This guy that we have on the show today made a documentary called 7852, which is just a documentary about the shower scene in Psycho.
Alexandra, you spent years of your life breaking down the shower scene. I just want to start by asking you... Why?
First of all, I think really I could say that I've been spending years of my life breaking down Hitchcock and trying to understand Hitchcock. I've been fascinated with him since I was a kid, and, you know, really growing up watching his movies. And, you know, growing up and eventually becoming an adult and eventually becoming a filmmaker, it occurred to me that this is, you know, the ultimate craftsman. This is a filmmaker who thinks so deeply about everything that he does that I became obsessed with really studying his craft in a way. And I quite frankly believe that his craft runs so deep that you can never, ever get to the bottom of it. And the shower scene is really the culmination of his entire career. It is the culmination of everything he has ever wished to express. It is the ultimate cinematic trick for him as a filmmaker. It is, I think, what he aspired to do, I think, to audiences for his entire career.
When you phrase it that way, it sounds zen.
Yes, absolutely. It is very zen in a certain way, I think, except that, you know, watching Janet Leigh getting stabbed to death over and over and over again is pretty much the exact opposite of a zen moment.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. You know, in your journey of deconstructing the scene, what was the biggest takeaway that you got from examining, besides just the technical aspect of what Hitchcock did, but was there something that you were able to take out of it on a more emotional level?
You know, we talk a lot about Psycho as being about Norman Bates, But I think Psycho is also very much the tragedy of Marion Crane. I mean, especially for a female character in 1960, is actually a very strong character who makes very strong choices. They're not necessarily the right choice, but she does choose to steal the money to be with the men she loves. She then makes the very strong choice, the very strong decision to return the money and face the consequences. I mean, how many characters are that strong? So from an emotional level, you know, the first half certainly of Psycho is very much about Marion Crane, and then it becomes the tragedy of Marion Crane. And the second half of Psycho is you know, I think inhabited by that particular spirit, by that particular sadness, that this is a film that is about two characters who you could certainly argue are doppelgangers in a certain way. You know, they've both made, you know, terrible choices in their lives. And they sort of, you know, there's this extraordinary scene in the parlor where they look at each other, they see each other for what they are. And I think Marion Crane recognizes in Norman Bates somebody that she could perhaps become. And that's when she stands up and says, you know what, I'm going to go back to Phoenix. I'm going to return the money and essentially imply I'm going to face the consequences.
Right.
But yet she steps into the shower and she is brutally murdered, and, you know, end of story. So that is part of the story, certainly a major element of the story that we don't talk about enough when we talk about Psycho. It's always Norman, Norman, Norman.
Well, you know? Yeah, it's interesting. We talk about this a lot on the podcast, the idea that certain movies just become like a meme. You know the scene, but the scene out of context loses its power, you know, whether it is the shower scene or You're Talking to Me.
You know, to piggyback on what you're saying here, what's interesting also and sort of unique about the shower scene, and I always use the example of, you know, if you know, humanity were to get, you know, wiped out from the face of the globe, and then, you know, 10,000 years from now, aliens come to Earth, and the only thing that they find is the shower scene.
Right.
It is still an artifact. It is still something that you can sort of put in a museum and it stands on its own. It's an extraordinary sort of, you know, piece of work in and of itself. But you're also absolutely right that within the context of the movie, it becomes greater. And then within the context of Hitchcock's entire career, it becomes even greater. I mean, you start seeing the sort of the ripple effect and the connections between the movies. And I mean, you could certainly argue that back in 1928, Hitchcock was already setting up the shower scene with the bathtub scene that happens in The Lodger. So, and there's many more such examples, of course, throughout his entire career.
Right, the idea that he keeps getting closer and closer, letting us hang out in bathrooms. Although also I'm thinking, like, if the aliens came to Earth and all they saw was our shower scene, I think they'd get a really bad idea of who we are as people.
No question about it, you know? I mean, especially today when we're finally having a dialogue. You know, about these things, where we're finally having a dialogue, a conversation about misogyny. This is a scene that is extraordinarily problematic. I mean, yes, of course, it's a piece of art, and yes, it's beautiful, and yes, it does some extraordinary things, but it's also, I mean, I think Hitchcock opened the Pandora's box by unleashing that particular scene on an unsuspecting sort of audience.
Do you think that this scene in particular set Hollywood and horror films on a track? I mean, like, because I think about that, like, you know, this scene and these, even these stereotypes of the person who did bad gets revenge, and then the more virginal character, you know, is able to, you know, save themselves. Like, I when I was watching the movie again the other night, I was like, oh, this is really the groundwork for everything that we see in the next, you know, 40 years.
Oh, I mean, completely. I mean, in fact, when it was Bret Easton Ellis who told me when I interviewed him, he said the shower scene is like a crack in the history of cinema, you know, and I think you can very much make the argument that, you know, there were movies before the shower scene and there were movies after the shower scene. And the reason for this, and this is what's so extraordinary, is that to be able to pull that particular cinematic trick in 1960, only Alfred Hitchcock would have been able to do it. It took, quite frankly, a magician at the time to be able to somehow convince the censors that this was going to be okay. I mean, if you read the memos from the Hayes office at the time, prior to Hitchcock shooting the scene, they made it very clear, looking at the script, that this was a no-go. This was not going to happen. There was no way that they were going to approve the scene being shot in this particular way. And what does Hitchcock do? He shoots it this way. He edits it this particular way, and they somehow end up not changing a single frame of it. There was something about the fact that Hitchcock was, you know, this the weird uncle that we had accepted, that we had somehow let him into our physical environment through our TV screens. And I think he somehow managed to also charm the censors. So, you know, anybody else directs the Psycho and directs the shower scene, I think you could make the argument that it doesn't fly.
Well, so Janet Leigh spent decades giving interviews after Psycho came out saying, that was me in the shower, that was all me in the shower, yeah. That was only me in the shower. Your documentary right. interviews a woman named Marley Renfro, and can you tell people who she is?
So Marley was the body double to Janet Leigh in the shower, and essentially every shot that you see in the film where you don't see Janet, well, sorry, every shot that you see in the shower where you don't actually see Janet Leigh's face is Marley. So it's her body, it's her belly button, it's her hand holding the shower curtain, it's her feet. It's a real shame that she had become this sort of forgotten hero of this extraordinarily important moment in the history of movies. And so to be able to bring her back and to give her that moment in the spotlight meant, well, it certainly meant a lot to me, but I know it meant a lot to her as well. So.
Yeah, I mean, she was only paid, I think, what, $500 for doing all of that work in the shower, for being the most famous body that nobody knew was her body. Why do you think they kept yeah. it hidden that it was her and not Janet Leigh?
Well, you know, this is what happens, I suppose, when, you know, not only a movie becomes this iconic, but then a moment becomes one of those things that, you know, comes around maybe every two or three decades. You know, everybody wants to claim it as their own. But I also want to sort of give a positive spin on it. You know, you look at Psycho and you look at the shower scene, and Janet Leigh's contributions are undeniable. And Saul Bass's contributions, if you look at the storyboards, are undeniable. But it's also important to say Marley Renfro's contributions were undeniable.
In your documentary, you interview Amy Duddleston, who edited the remake of Psycho, and she tried to edit this remake of the shower scene, and she said she didn't work. I mean, what do you think happened there?
This is one of those things that really becomes one of those Zen moments you were talking about, something that I think about very actively. Because, you know, you're talking about a great, great director, right, Gus Van Sant, and obviously, you know, a great team of people, and they're shooting and editing the scene exactly the way that it was shot and edited. And it just didn't work, as Amy Duddleston says. And my little sort of pet theory is this, that if something is actually perfect, you can probably replicate it if you have the right sort of team. And I'll give you an example, you know, something that I don't really like to watch, but Marvel movies, right? Marvel movies are so, it's like clockwork. It's everything is so well done. You could put any really competent director behind it and a really competent sort of team of actors and crew, and they can probably pretty much replicate it. The problem with Psycho and the problem with great movies is that you're talking about a genius, in this case, Alfred Hitchcock, who is trying to pull something off that is already beyond his capacity, that is beyond the means of his time. And therefore, it is chock full of mistakes. It is chock full of essentially sort of his fingerprints all over this film of trying to cover his tracks. Well, one thing that you cannot replicate is human mistakes. And so to me, what it says is that the greatness of movies is not in the perfections. It is in the imperfections of geniuses like an Alfred Hitchcock. And you can never, ever, ever replicate that. And I think that's the lesson that Gus Van Sant actually learned.
So the next film that you're making, I've heard, is about the chestbuster scene in Alien. Is it okay if I just say that out loud?
You can say it out loud, but let me actually recalibrate what you just said. It was initially a film about the chestburster scene. It is now essentially a full-on sort of mythological take about Alien. It's an origin story. We're working actually very closely with the estate of Dan O'Bannon, and specifically his widow, Diane O'Bannon, and the estate of H.R. Giger. And, you know, we're linking Alien to Greek mythology, to Egyptian mythology, and we're actually finishing the film right now.
So do you think every movie is this important if you really, really thought about it?
No. I think the great movies are movies that tap into the collective unconscious. And I think that the reason why you can never get to the bottom of Psycho and the reason why you can never get to the bottom of Alien is because those are movies that tapped into, or that resonated with, the collective unconscious by tapping into images that go really, really deeply into our collective past. You know, there's very few movies, actually, that do that.
Absolutely. This has been so fascinating talking to you. And I have one last question for you. And in your opinion, do you think when Marion Crane is getting stabbed, she recognizes that it's Norman Bates dressed as his mother? Or does she think that she's being stabbed by an old woman? What do you think? Just your gut.
You know, so Stephen Rebello, who wrote Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, which is a great book, by the way, and who's also in 1752, he actually got to interview Janet Leigh, and he asked her that particular question, and that's exactly what she responded. She said that she, as she was dying, you know, there was that recognition that it was Norman wearing the clothes of his mother, and that's the last thing that she sees.
Oh, the saddest moment.
You think, I mean, what a way to go, right?
Amazing. And of course, we want people to watch your documentary if they have not seen it. It's 7852. You also made an amazing documentary that I'm a fan of, The People versus George Lucas. You have this new film coming out. Anywhere else we can tell people to find you or follow you? Anything at all?
Yeah, I mean, our website is exhibitapictures.com. They can find us on Facebook, and probably just joining us on Facebook is the best way to you know, to keep track of what we're doing. Our upcoming film is actually called Memory, and that's because, well, before Alien was called Alien, it was called Star Beast, and before it was called Star Beast, it was called Memory. And but yeah, I think Facebook is probably a good way to get updates from us.
Very exciting. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for talking Psycho.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
Well, that was awesome having him in here. And oh, I forgot to ask him this. I want to talk about this music cue that we have in the middle of the shower scene, where it goes from that famous, like, reek, 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 to it just shifts automatically. And let's play it first and then talk about it. I love that shift the violins to the cellos, because you just get the sense of a life pumping out of her body. Like, the attack is over and now it's all just death.
Like John Williams, Bernard Herrmann makes music that just kind of is inside of you. You will never unhear that. That's so locked into me. Like, I will never forget that score.
It rattles inside of you.
And it's, you know, and I know I've mentioned my love for, you know, a lot of things Marvel. And very rarely do you walk away from a Marvel movie going, I like that score. It's a very interesting technique. I think Michael Giacchino has it. I think John Williams has it. Though it's a very tricky thing to get some, like, a score into the zeitgeist. I love Lauren Baff on the new Mission Impossible too. I thought I've been listening to that score a lot. It's great.
I feel like I should admit this to you right now while we're in the safety of the studio.
Yeah.
I've been singing songs made up to the Psycho theme song to my cat
a
lot.
Oh my gosh.
I love that. It's just really
easy. Would you
like
to present one?
No, I would not. I just suddenly confessed that for no reason.
I love it. But talking about music, I pulled this clip from Hitchcock that I thought was interesting, and I want to play it, and let's discuss.
While we are talking about the analogy of music, this could even apply to its small scenes. For example, in Psycho, you have the shock of a murder of a detective. He is coming up the stairs. This is ordinary orchestration. And then the camera goes very high. And now we say it is like the violins in a tremolo. And suddenly the figure runs out with the knife And when it comes down, the cut, the coupage is a cut, is a big head. And that is like going from violins to brass instruments which shout.
I just love that he looks at movies like conducting an orchestra.
Well, he talks about the audience like that. I mean, this is what he said about making Psycho. He said, quote, "The audience is like a giant organ. At one moment, we play this note on them and get this reaction, and then we play that chord and they react this way. And someday we won't even have to make a movie. There will be electrodes implanted in their brains, and we'll just hit different buttons and they'll go, ooh, and ah."
Let's talk a little bit about sequels here. This is a movie that is so successful and launches 4 sequels. The second one is not bad. I actually think it's kind of surprisingly good. It has a lot of people from the first movie in it. Vera Miles comes back, Anthony Perkins, and Virginia Gregg. And then Psycho 3 is much more of like a slasher weird movie. And then I think Psycho 4 was an HBO movie that comes back. But it's interesting, this fascination with this character, because then we even now go to the Bates Motel, which is a whole nother telling of the story. But it's odd because this, I don't think this is a movie that needs a sequel per se.
Not at all. And the gap is so long between them. I mean, we're talking, what, like 22 years between Psycho and Psycho 2?
Psycho 2 comes out in 1983, so 63 to 83. And then Psycho 3 is 86.
Yeah. I mean, what's weird is what happens is Janet Leigh's daughter makes Halloween.
Right.
Because Jamie Lee Curtis was the person that they first asked to star in Psycho 2.
Oh, wow.
Because you get, after Halloween, you get this giant slasher boom, and they're like, what about the first slasher? Because this is sort of the first slasher,
right.
Sort of not enough of a body count to really be the first slasher.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that Jamie Lee was deliberately asked, like, do you want to be in the key of your mom in this movie that's like a sequel to your mom's movie when you are the new Scream Queen? And she was like, no, I am so done making slasher films.
It was a great choice, obviously, because, you know, Norman Bates is a more nuanced character than a Jason Voorhees or Freddy Krueger. I mean, those characters are basically vehicles for killing, right? I mean, they're not, you know, yes, there's backstory about Jason Voorhees and the mom, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, I think that's why Halloween 1 is so kind of great. The sequel to Halloween seems like it got rid of all the other ones and kind of is focusing more on the trauma of that and what comes after that. I think that's actually an interesting story to tell, but these are not characters that you can build. Like, now Norman Bates moves to a bigger motel in Orlando. You know, it's not like, I don't know, it's not a commercialized villain in a weird way. You know, it's a more interesting psychological villain.
Well, yeah, because what's weird is when you bring a franchise back and back and back and back, especially when the main thing you're keeping is the villain, the villain's who you maybe start to care about. The villains who you're like, that's my way in. I like that guy, especially when it's a villain like Norman Bates.
Well, and Norman Bates is a guy who I think the second film did a great job of saying, like, he's trying to get back on his feet. Like, this idea, like, it's 23 years later, he's out of the mental institution, he's good. And then, you know, I think it's revealed that, like, Vera Miles, the sister, is, like, trying to basically put him back in. You know, which is a cool story because it's sort of like, oh, this man who killed my sister is out of the mental ward. I want to get him back in. You know, I like that.
There is something to be said that, like, you watch Psycho and you kind of can forget that Vera Miles was even in it, so who cares?
Right. But, like, it's very rare that you find, like, a likable, articulate serial killer. You know, it's, like, normally mask and knife and you know. So.
Well, because he's introduced to us as a person who's bullied.
Right.
By his mom. Like, our first real impression of him is that he's a guy who, if he had a hug, maybe none of this would have happened. Mm-hmm. If he didn't have to, like, have only his mom as his emotional support, maybe it could have been better. Like, you look at Norman Bates and you're like, it didn't have to be like this, man.
Right.
So, we were talking about Vince Vaughn being really miscast as Norman Bates. And what I find really interesting about the Psycho remake is that I think that what Gus Van Sant does is he just literalizes everything that Hitchcock couldn't quite do because of the censors. You almost feel this pressure of him being like, Hitchcock wanted to do all these things and he couldn't because of his budget, and I will do it for him. You know, like Hitchcock in that opening scene, he wanted to do a smooth, cool zoom over Phoenix into the hotel room.
Right.
He couldn't really afford to. It was harder to do it back then.
Right, he had no money, yeah.
Yeah, so Gus Van Sant's like, I'll do it for you. And he does. Or like Gus Van Sant is like, Hitchcock couldn't show that when Vera Miles goes into Norman Bates' bedroom, she's flipping through this book that he owns,
And it was like softcore porn. He's like, I'll do it. Here's a magazine full of porn for you. And he makes literal things I don't know that we needed to make literal. Like, I don't want to be too gross here, but listen for the sound that Vince Vaughn is making as he's peeping through Marion Crane in the wall. That's a belt.
Yeah.
Coming open.
And you know, this is a student film project. It's like, I don't know if this should have been released in theaters, and I don't think that if he didn't win the Oscar, and at this time, this could have been something that you would have seen on like Amazon Prime. No offense, Amazon Prime.
I don't know. I mean, I will say though, I do still enjoy the Gus Van Sant Psycho for a couple reasons.
All right.
I think Anne Heche is a really great Marion Crane.
She's very good.
Because I like Janet Leigh a lot, but there's something in Anne Heche that is incredibly, incredibly like jittery and anxious. And I think she channels this energy into the Marion Crane that makes her seem more unstable. It makes her seem more vulnerable.
Right.
And I enjoy that about it. And also just on a superficial level, the clothes in the new Psycho are really great. They're like insane. I mean, well, they're like mismatched plaids. You've got like Viggo Mortensen, our lovely human knight showing up. And he's dressed crazy. And it makes me so happy. And then you've got Julianne Moore, you know, because Vera Miles,
she's so great in that movie.
She's so great. Julianne Moore almost makes Lila Crane seem like a character.
Yes.
You have this throwaway line in the original Psycho where they're like, Lila Crane, you know, she works at a music shop. And you're like, okay. And then Julianne Moore shows up and she's got this Walkman around her neck where she's like, no, I really do like music, y'all. I'm really into music. And at the end of one scene when they're like leaving, she's like, hold on, let me get my Walkman. You're like, okay, get your Walkman to go interview Norman Bates.
Good stuff, I guess. I just think it's like cool to see the experiment. It's not fulfilling to me as a film. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. That's neat. I like these performances, but I don't walk out going, I don't go out. And this is somebody who just saw Psycho this week, who was like, I'm totally caught up in this movie, and I'm never getting there with a Gus Van Sant one. That's at least how I feel about it.
That's fair. But think about this. How weird is it that Hitchcock's got North by Northwest? Okay, I'm making Psycho.
Right.
And then Gus Van Sant's like, Good Will Hunting? Cool, I'm making Psycho. And then this year, we have Luca, who just made Call Me By Your Name, being like, cool, I'm redoing Suspiria.
Right.
That we keep having this repeated pattern of like, I did one for the Academy. I did one for Prestige. I did one for Money. Check me out. I'm doing something super nasty and fun for me.
But I kind of disagree with that, because it's not like I'm doing one for me. It's like I'm doing a cover now, which is like, wait, but no, the reason what we like, make another original thing, because that's what we're responding to, is your voice, not your thing. Now, Suspiria seems like it's going to break that trend, because I feel like everyone is losing their mind over it.
It seems radically different. I haven't seen it yet because I keep missing it. And I'm like, ah.
And I feel like that maybe is the right way to go about it. But I feel like, why do a cover? Like, unless you're going to bring something uniquely different to it. If this came out right now, we never saw Psycho, and it was made, you would be like, wow, that was a great, wow, I didn't know that was coming. I was totally blown away by that. You know, it's like that idea of like a real shocking horror film. Well, the way I felt about
Hereditary. Let me ask you this, though. I'm holding a Sharpie now for people who listen. I'm holding a Sharpie with an orange cap. If I held this Sharpie in front of you and it was the Men in Black, like, mind eraser.
Yeah.
And I was like, Psycho doesn't exist.
Right.
And then you saw a 2018 Psycho right now that was exactly the same. Or maybe even this one. Would you be like, yes, that movie goes on the AFI Top 100 list?
Well, that's, I think, the thing, because this movie is about what, not only what it is, but what it does for cinema. It kind of lays DNA in to everything. And it is incredibly watchable. I think we're coming up upon this thing where in the beginning of doing the AFI list, I think I was thinking about it big, going like, all these movies, they mean something and they're important. And now I think I'm going more to this other point where I'm like, did I enjoy it? And yeah, this is enjoyable to me. So if I enjoyed it, I mean, but then we would go like, well, would I put Get Out on this list, on the AFI Top 100 list? You know, maybe it's not long enough to know, but it's the same idea. It's an enjoyable movie that plays on similar elements and reinvents them in a very unique way.
I feel dangerous broaching this part of the conversation, but Psycho is, like I said, our highest Hitchcock movie. I don't think I enjoy watching Psycho. in 2018. As much as I enjoy watching a lot of his other films, a lot of his lesser films even, like The Lady Vanishes or Saboteur, I watch those movies and to me they are wall-to-wall fun and intelligent and surprising and suspenseful from minute one to the end of it.
Right.
To me, Hitchcock, and it, I think a lot of it is because so much of this movie was ruined before I was born.
Right. You I never really, got to experience it pure. I remember being freaked out when I saw this movie, saw that shower scene. I was freaked out to take a shower. I don't think I knew about it fully, and then it really blew my mind. Yeah.
To me, I'm like, if half of Psycho is Vera Miles and John Gavin, like, puttering around.
Right.
That's, like, we never think about that part of the movie.
And yes,
if
you're right.
If half the movie is basically, like, styrofoam peanuts.
Well, then,
does it deserve to be 14?
Well, okay. Well, no, but all right, let's talk about it. Because, look, that was my argument against Platoon. I thought the first half of Platoon was great. I didn't think the second half was great. And I think you can make the same argument here. I think that there's something about that end, which is fine. It just, but it's also one of those movies, because I am so familiar with it, that I don't know how to disassociate it from what it means to me. Like, Psycho is a movie that I've seen probably, you know, 8-9 times, maybe more, you know, at least this version of it.
I don't know, but I feel the same way. I look at this at 14 and I'm like, number 14 and half the movie kind of could not exist and we'd be fine.
Right.
And that's bizarre to me when like but All the, About Eve is wall-to-wall.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. It's an interesting conversation.
But I mean, I feel like an asshole even mentioning it because it's like its footprint is so large in cinema.
But that's what I think we're kind of finding with this list. Maybe it's a thing where it starts to become so locked into our consciousness that we're just checking a box. Psycho. Yes, I love Psycho. Have you seen it? Like in 5 years? No, but I love it. You know, it's like, and that's maybe part of the thing about this list. And there's 100 movies here, so maybe there's plenty of room for that too. Well, what about other critics? Did other critics have a negative reaction to this movie?
Actually, yeah. This movie had a lot of polarizing reactions right when it came out. I'm going to read a review from C.A. Lejeune, who wrote for The Observer.
Okay.
And I want to preface this review with a little bit about C.A. Lejeune. C.A. stood for Carolyn Alice. She was one of the very first movie critics. She was a female movie critic who started in the 20s.
Okay.
She reviewed films for 40 years. She, in a lot of ways, is a really amazing figure for all film critics. You know, we're still not talking about, like, we need more female film critics. But the truth is, from the history of cinema, we've had a lot of really great film critics who we've just forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
She's one of them. She was major. She was this kind of like comfortably middle class, intelligent, literary woman who, when movies really started to exist in the 20s and were like a major form of entertainment, she threw away her whole life and moved to London and became a film critic. So I want to put all of that down as a preface before I talk about how much C.A. Lejeune hated Psycho. She said, quote, "A new film by Alfred Hitchcock is usually a keen enjoyment. Psycho turns out to be an exception. There follows one of the most disgusting murders in all of screen history. It takes place in a bathroom and involves a great deal of swabbing of all the tiles and flushings of the lavatory. It might be described with fairness as plug ugly. The stupid air of mystery and portent surrounding Psycho's presentation strikes me as a tremendous error. I couldn't give away the ending if I wanted to, for the simple reason that I grew so sick and tired of the whole beastly business that I didn't stop to see it. Your edict may keep me out of the theater, my dear Hitchcock, but I'll be hanged if it will keep me in." So she walked out of this. She walked out of a movie called Peeping Tom, which is also a proto-slasher that came out that year. And then she quit reviewing movies because that year she thought, everybody really likes these. I think they're trash and garbage and horrible and gross. And maybe I'm just out of step. She was in her 60s by then. And so Psycho is another one of those cases where a critic is like, I'm out because I don't get why you like this movie.
We keep on coming up against this. This is a movie that pushes cinema forward for better or for worse. You know, if you're older, you're probably saying, well, what happened to better storytelling and why is it so vulgar? But yet without this, we don't get another style of storytelling. I think that, you know, yes, this pushes forward horror, but I think it also pushes forward what we see on camera, the types of people and characters. And I think, you know, this definitely affects probably the younger generation who in the 60s is seeing this in a formative time, who then makes movies in the 70s, where I think a lot of conflicted characters are on display, characters that are likable bad guys.
Because where we do see the code come into play is one of the codes I think last rules to get rid of was bad characters must get punished.
Right.
And you do see that in Psycho. Bad characters do get punished.
But he's being, treated more than punished. But you're right. Yeah, I mean, he definitely pays for his sins. I would have found it to be more interesting if they could never have figured it out. you know, maybe that's the way to remake it. Let me tell you, though, we were talking about a lot about it at the time. So let me give you a couple year facts.
Year facts.
All right, so 1960, the monthly rent is $98. Cost of a gallon of gas is 25 cents. A loaf of bread is 20 cents. And in 1960, the Cold War continued to become colder as the two sides distrusted each other and tried to influence other parts of the world. John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson won the presidency with one of the smallest margins in history. Sexual revolution had begun, the use of birth control pills, and Hugh Hefner opened the first Playboy Club in Chicago. The Flintstones is on TV for the first time. The U.S. sends their first troops to Vietnam. It's in a year where, in many respects, we are going into a different era. The 60s is, the doors are opening. I mean, clearly.
Yeah, I mean, Ben-Hur and Psycho in the same year is really interesting.
Well, one kind of seems like the old school and one kind of seems like the new school, even though Ben-Hur is using all the effects and everything, and Psycho's going minimal and doing black and white. They're both pushing different parts of the culture. One is pushing past it and the other one's kind of embracing it. You
know? It's true. And by the way, if we're talking about the value of a dollar, that $40,000 that Marion steals was worth about $370,000.
I was wondering about that. And now, Amy, is there a Simpsons clip?
Well, but of course there's a Simpsons clip. Here is a clip from a Simpsons episode called Brother from the Same Planet. And it is the one where Lisa is addicted to a hotline of the Coreys, where it's like Corey Haim and Corey Feldman. I'm doing a sign of the cross right here. Yeah. And in pity for both of them. And it is one of the first steps of the Simpsons kind of running joke that Principal Skinner is basically Norman Bates.
Lisa, the only way you'll lick this is one day at a time. If you can make it to midnight without calling the Corey line, you'll know you've beaten it forever.
Midnight?
Listen to your mother, Lisa. I owe everything I have to my mother's watchful eye and swift hand. Oh, there's Mother now, watching me. What's that, Mother? Well, they have a right to be here. It's school business. I... Mother, that sailor suit doesn't fit anymore!
Well, you know, we've talked a lot about what we think about the movie. We've talked a lot about what Alfred Hitchcock's intent was. I thought this clip was kind of interesting about what Hitchcock thought about Psycho.
I once made a movie, rather tongue-in-cheek, called Psycho.
Yes.
And of course, a lot of people looked at this thing and said, what a dreadful thing to do, how awful, and so forth. But of course, it was, to me, it had great elements of the cinema in it. The content as such was, I felt, rather amusing. And it was a big joke, you know. And I was horrified to find that some people took it seriously.
Like Hitchcock basically saying that Psycho is a comedy.
Whoa, I mean, Hitchcock... I mean, even in interviews at the time, Hitchcock doesn't seem to have seen Psycho as a full-bodied movie.
Right.
Like, he said that to him, Psycho, quote, it wasn't a message that stirred the audience or a great performance or even their enjoyment of the novel. It was just pure film. Psycho, more than any of my other films, belongs to filmmakers. That it was almost him talking to directors and being like, hey, look what we can do, even more than being like, I will give you something really complex and brilliant. Okay, Paul.
All right.
I got a lot of notes on this table, and they are aching to have a big ball dropped on them. Let's drop this ball and see what our next movie's going to be.
I love it. Drop it.
It is 66.
Ooh, 66 is Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I'm so excited. I feel like this is the movie I've seen probably the most on this list.
This is the movie with a scene I know better than almost any scene, so we're going to get into it. Oh, my God. Okay, yes.
You know, Amy, a lot of people have seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, so I don't think this is a spoiler if I say that for next week's podcast, why don't you call in and tell us what else you think might be in those crates in the National Archive. At the very end of the movie, we see an old man pushing the ark down an alley full of many, many crates. What else are in those crates? Let us know your thoughts.
Oh, I like that, because this is a movie that people know so well, but yet there's that mystery.
Yeah, what's in those crates?
What's in the crates? Well, then the number to call is 747-666-5824. That's 747-666-5824. And tell us, what is in the box?
What's in the box is the other boxes. So Continue the conversation online on our Twitter page at Unspooled or on our Facebook group, which has really just become its own thing. We love it. As we're getting close to our 25th episode, which means we're a quarter of the way there, we would love for you to send us any movies that we talked about in this show that we thought belong on the list. Sometimes we forget them, and we're going to be updating our website with all of that information very soon. But you can find that information as is right now at the unspooledpod.com. Unspooledpod.com. And thanks for some of these great research notes from our friend Morgan Messenheimer, who is doing this as part of their college study.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, what
yeah.
is this? I don't know about this.
I should give you some of these notes. These are the notes that Morgan has been sending, doing some deep dives. You already have so many great notes, so I'm getting a little extra help from Morgan.
Paul, do you know the number of times I've told people Paul just must stay up all night working so hard?
I do.
He's so busy.
I do. Normally I do. This is just from Morgan. The last two have been from Morgan, but I also am doing it. I'm doing the work.
Morgan, you're doing a great job. And Paul, I have been continually impressed because people who listen know that Paul's like the busiest man in Hollywood right now. You got your two kids, you got your wife, you got your million TV shows and stuff going on. So the fact that you get so much research done yourself has really impressed me this entire
show.
Well,
you're nice to say it. I like doing it.
All right, that's next week. We'll see you guys then.
Hey, this is Arnie Niekamp from the improv fantasy podcast Hello from the Magic Tavern. I fell through a dimensional portal behind a Burger King in Chicago into the magical land of Foon, and I started a podcast. Season 3 has just begun with a brand new adventure to defeat the Dark Lord. If you're a new listener or you've fallen behind, Season 3 is a great jumping on point. And we've got great guests like Justin McElroy.
I sound like a fancy college professor. Eight nuts.
Rachel Bloom.
You want to see my collection of men corpses and one woman?
Felicia Day and Colton Dunn.
You've seen me have intercourse with a variety of species.
It's a bummer.
Andy Daly.
You have the members of Genesis listed, but Phil Collins is crossed out and then circled and crossed out again.
Yes, I have killed Phil Collins twice.
Thomas Middleditch.
Jesus! I mean, Jazos! Ruler of the Eighth Circle!
And that's just the beginning. Season 3 of Hello from the Magic Tavern is out now. Listen in Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.